So we come this morning to 1 Samuel chapter 13. And the title that I've given this is Saul, brackets only, close brackets, the king. Now, who's in charge? The issue of sovereignty in our country is very much live at the moment. One of the justifications for the Brexit referendum related to people feeling that somehow we'd lost sovereignty to the European Union. The supporters of Brexit felt that it was somehow better for a country to be in charge of itself. Since then, and more so in the last few months, issues and questions about sovereignty have arisen over and over again. Who is in charge? The Prime Minister or the Cabinet? Who's in charge? The government or Parliament as a whole? Who's in charge? The government or the legal system? Does the government have the freedom to disregard conventional ways of doing things? How much authority does the Queen have over the government? Now, doubtless we all have our own answers to these questions. I'm quite happy to talk about them. But we don't come to church to talk about politics, do we? Not to start with, anyway. But to learn what God has said to us. Now, what is interesting about this passage in 1 Samuel chapter 13, this account from the life of King Saul, is that again we find ourselves wrestling with issues of sovereignty. Who's in charge of what? And who should be in charge? And why? So what happened? What is going on in 1 Samuel chapter 13? What we've seen in 1 Samuel up to now is Samuel effectively ruling, behaving as a judge over Israel. Now, let's see if you're aware. There's a word for this sort of government, this form of government, ruled by a judge. Does anyone know what it is? I didn't know what it is this week. And so, does anyone else know what it is? Critarchy or critocracy, apparently. It's a little bit misleading because the nature of the rule of the judges in Israel was that they were ruling effectively with God over them. So technically speaking, it was really probably more of a theocracy than rule by a judge. It's a slightly odd concept. It's not one that you see very commonly in the world today. It's hard to see examples of similar patterns outside the Bible. But has anyone been to Iceland? Anyone been to Iceland? A few people have been to Iceland. If you look at the history of Iceland, around about 1,000 years ago, round about between AD 900 and I think 1200 or thereabouts, the rule over Iceland was kind of similar, ruled by judges. But more significantly, from the point of view of what we're looking at today, this is a pattern that the people of Israel have got increasingly frustrated with in 1 Samuel chapter 8. They've come to Samuel to say that what they really want is a king. Now, why? What's wrong with Samuel as a judge ruling on behalf of God or helping to rule on behalf of God over the people of Israel? We can see part of what the issue is when they say to Samuel in chapter 8, well, you're old and your sons don't follow your ways. But then in this, in 1 Samuel 8 verse 19, that they refused to listen to Samuel. No, they said, we want a king over us. Then we will be like all the other nations, with a king to lead us and to go out before us and fight our battles. The leadership they have seems to the people of Israel to be passive. It seems to be lacking in initiative. The leadership they want would be visible. It would be the focus of the nation, in the same way that other nations had rulers who they looked to. Now, it's misleading, of course. God is their king. He rules the affairs of the nation. They're supposed to be looking to him. They're supposed to be trusting in him. And throughout the era of the judges, God has shown that he is quite capable of leading his people out and fighting for them. But the people of Israel don't recognize how God is doing that for them and want their leadership to be expressed through a human king. Now, the Lord speaks to Samuel and says, this isn't your failure. It's the people of Israel who are sinning in asking for this. But ultimately, the Lord accepts their request for a king. And in the following chapters that we've been looking at over the last few weeks and also before the summer, that gives us an account of how Saul ended up being proclaimed as the king of Israel. And last week, we saw Samuel seemingly standing down from his leading role in the leadership of the Israelites, and almost, in a sense, handing over responsibility to King Saul. So what effect does the coronation of Saul have on the nation? Well, initially, as we've seen in the last few chapters, he does provide exactly the sort of military focus that the nation might have wanted. Saul rescues the city of Jabesh Gilead from the Ammonite army. He behaves in a gracious manner to the people who didn't believe him. He says, I'm not that there's going to be no more deaths. But at the start of chapter 13, as we start this reading, things seem already to be losing focus. From the 330,000 fighters that were mustered in chapter 11, Saul starts off by scaling back the army just to 3,000 or so. These are divided between a larger group where he is, 2,000 with Saul, and a smaller group under Jonathan. Now, maybe fired up, excited by what has happened, Jonathan attacks the Philistine outpost at Geba. It's a small raid. He's only got 1,000 people. But this small raid is like poking a hornet's nest, poking a bee's nest. And from the state of uneasy truce that's existed between the Philistines and the Israelites, things rapidly go downhill. The Philistines decide it's time to teach these upstart Israelites a lesson. Get them back in their place. And whereas the situation, the impression that we get, the situation has been largely demilitarized, all of a sudden the Israelites are facing as many armed chariots as the size of their standing army. Did you notice that? The Israelites have 3,000 men available to fight. The Philistines have got 3,000 chariots, plus a huge army on foot. Now, it's a fairly classic scene in films. Someone threatens to start a fight with somebody, and they're sitting down maybe, and says, I'm going to fight you. I want to fight you now. And then they stand up, and they're towering over the person who had threatened them. Or the good guy casts the first punch at the bad guy's stomach, throws the punch, and he just shakes his hand because it just hurts his hand. Meanwhile, the bad guy is just standing there completely impassive. That's the kind of note here. At the end of chapter 13, we get more insight into how desperate the situation of the Israelites is. At the moment, Israel simply doesn't have the means of producing metal weapons, it seems. Now, the USA has a policy where high-tech stuff can't be sold to countries where it might be weaponized. So there are certain things which are not allowed to be exported from the USA to various countries in the world in case they turn them into weapons and the USA gets them thrown back at them, I guess. And that's what we see the policy of the Philistines is here. They're the ones who control the ironworking. They only do ironwork for the Israelites under license. And as Keith commented, there's a price list. Here's a price list. You want to sharpen your plow? Give us your shekels. Do you want your mattock sharpened? Do you want your goad sharpened? Now, a goad is a thing that you use to spike, to prick animals, to get them to go the way. It's not a spear. This is just a metal tool that allows you to get on with your day-to-day work. And the Philistines say, well, if you want that sharpened, then you pay us. You give us your money. The effect of this is not only do the Philistines have a huge, sudden, numeric superiority, but they also have vastly superior tech. Only Saul and Jonathan, we're told, even have spears. All of a sudden, the men of Israel, as we saw in this chapter, realize just how much trouble they're in, humanly speaking. People start to melt away. That's what's going on there. That's where, in the verses in that chapter, where it talks about the fact they hid in caves and thickets among the rocks and in pits and cisterns, some Hebrews even crossed the Jordan to the land of Gad and Gilead. People are trying to get out of the way. They're trying to hide. They're making themselves small. Find placing to hide in the wilderness, thinking this is not going to go well for us. Keith said, you want to know what happened next? Well, the military side of it is not our focus this week. If you want to know more about that, I guess you need to come back next week. When we look into the next chapter, we'll see exactly how this pans out. But in the midst of all this, Saul is still at Gilgal, where his coronation has taken place. We haven't been given much detail, but it seems to be the case that he's waiting for Samuel to return. Samuel told him to wait there for a week, perhaps. Now, Saul is well-intentioned here. He sets out to wait, exactly apparently as Samuel has told him. And he does this in faith. Even though the army is shrinking away, the people around him are shrinking away and losing heart, he's holding on there. He's sticking with what he believes. And Saul also knows that there's a need for sacrifices. That what is needed is a priestly action. that will bring the people God's favour, that will draw the people towards God. He knows that that's part of what is needed from Samuel. But then he makes a mistake. The week goes past, 7 days has gone past, and he thinks, right, that's it, Samuel's not coming. I need to get these sacrifices done or I'm going to have nobody left to fight with me here at all. I need to seek the favour of the Lord. So he gets the sacrificial animals out that have been got ready for the occasion and makes the sacrificial offerings himself. Literally, as soon as this takes place, now the process, I imagine, probably takes maybe an hour or two, something like that. And literally, as soon as it has happened, Samuel arrives. What have you done? Asked Samuel. And Saul explains how the people were slipping away from him. The Philistines were ranged against him. He needed to seek the favor of the Lord. And Samuel hadn't turned up in time. And so he'd forced himself to do it. It was a foolish thing to do, Samuel replies. You've not kept the command of the Lord. Had you done that, your throne would have been established forever. But instead, Samuel says, your throne, your kingdom is not going to continue. Now, from our perspective, this is really quite baffling, isn't it? There's a war going on. There's an army of thousands of Philistines parked just up the road. And I've got these troops here, and I've made an offering to God, and Samuel comes along and says, your kingdom is not going to last. It's like, well, I don't even know I'm going to last. I've got an army ranged against me. The army was small at the start of the chapter. It's dispirited. It's facing a Philistine army that is tens or maybe hundreds of times bigger, with vastly better technology. We're embarrassingly under-equipped. You know, Samuel, I really believe that God will fight on our side, but we have this issue in our relationship with God. We need to seek his favor, and you just weren't here. But facing this military crisis, this war that's about to blow up around them, Samuel turns up and tells Saul that his actions have lost his family the right to the kingdom. What has that got to do with anything? So what is it? Why was it wrong? What is it that Saul had done wrong? Now, to understand that, we need to do some digging. Even though the people of Israel had not had a king before, God had already foreseen this eventuality. God had already planned it. I have no doubt at all that this has already been covered. This may be fresh in your mind from other times that we've looked at this section of 1 Samuel. But in Deuteronomy chapter 17, part of the law God gave to Moses was related to what a king ought to be like. So let's read through some of this. Deuteronomy chapter 17, when you enter the land the Lord your God is giving you and have taken possession of it and settled in it, and you say, let us set a king over us like the nations around us, which is exactly what the Israelites have done. Be sure to appoint over you a king the Lord your God chooses. He must be from among your fellow Israelites. Do not place a foreigner over you, one who is not an Israelite. The king, moreover, must not acquire great numbers of horses for himself or make the people return to Egypt to get more of them, for the Lord has told you, you are not to go back that way again. He must not take many wives, or his heart will be led astray. He must not accumulate large amounts of silver and gold. When he takes the throne of his kingdom, he is to write for himself on a scroll a copy of this law taken from that of the Levitical priests. It is to be with him, and he is to read it all the days of his life, so that he may learn to revere the Lord his God and follow carefully all the words of this law and these decrees, and not consider himself better than his fellow Israelites, and turn from the law to the left or to the right. Then he and his descendants will reign a long time over the kingdom of Israel. And can you see that last phrase is the exact opposite of what Samuel has said to Saul? Now, a lot is going on in this passage, but let's just mention a few of them. Firstly, the king of Israel does not simply have arbitrary, unconstrained power. Now, when we think about kings, when we think about kings within feudal systems or within the medieval history and things like that, until Magna Carta and things like that, what we tend to think of is someone who has unlimited power. Now, that was not the situation for the people of Israel. The framework for the kingdom in Israel is God's law. The king of Israel does not have the freedom to interpret his kingship how he chooses. The power of the king is defined by God's law. The king can't write or interpret laws that he wants to. He's not an absolute monarch, if you like. He rules in the context of the law that already exists. In other words, he rules under God. There is, if you like, a written constitution. So that's the first thing. Second thing, this passage in Deuteronomy chapter 17 has a specific reminder that the authority of the king is separate from the priestly authority. Look at what goes on there. Taken from that of the Levitical priest. In other words, the priests are the one who have this law. The king, in a sense, is taking the law from the priests, is bringing the law across from the priests. The king would not necessarily be a Levite, unlike the priests. And the instruction from Moses is that the Levitical priests are, in effect, mediating the law of God. So the law of God is looked after by the priests, and the king takes the law from the priests. The Levitical priests are mediating the law of God. They're standing between the people and God. The Levites are the ones who should be making sacrifices and offerings. That's what else the law of God says. So the king is not the highest authority. The law is there. And also, the work of the priests is separate from the work of the king. And that's not a new thing. That was all put in place in Deuteronomy chapter 17. That was all put in place at the time of Moses. And thirdly, here's a direct echo of what Samuel said that I've mentioned already. Obedience to the law is linked here to the ongoing rule of the king and his descendants. Moses says in the law, Moses writes into the law, if the king obeys the law of God, then he will continue to reign. His sons, there will be a succession. That will be his rule. And the implication of that is if he doesn't obey the law of God, then it will be cut off. Now, to what extent would Saul have understood this? Let's remind ourselves of the process that's taken place. It seems likely that that ground would have been covered by Samuel in the process of the last few months, as Saul has been appointed. 1 Samuel 10 verse 25. Samuel explained to the people the rights and duties of kingship. He wrote them down on a scroll and deposited it before the Lord. Then Samuel dismissed the people to go to their own homes. Samuel has revised for the people of God what the laws about kings are supposed to be. He says, the rules are there. Here, I'm going to write them down for you. And we're going to do this in the sight of God. I'm in a slightly strange situation at work, in that as a pilot, I have to know an awful lot of stuff about an awful lot of situations, but most of that stuff I don't have to know most of the time, unsurprisingly. So what happens is that I will go for 6 months doing routine flying, and where the most difficult thing I have to cope with is a late turn onto the final approach or a heavy shower or something like that. And then after 6 months, I go into the simulator, and when I'm in the simulator, they throw everything they can at me. And the reason they do that is because if I don't practice it, which I don't normally, then I forget about it. Now, it's a similar sort of thing that goes on here. When a king is appointed, the law is written down to remind them, look, here's the law. This is what it says. You may not be familiar with this section. You may not be used to it, but it's got to rule your life. You've got to work on the basis that it's there. So when in 1 Samuel 13 verse 14, Samuel says that Saul has not done what has commanded of him, what he means is that Saul has already disobeyed the instructions that were given for him as a king. Hardly any time has passed since the coronation, but already it's gone wrong. And when we look at these passages, we see how. The offering of sacrifices is a priestly function that is supposed to be carried out by the Levites. And Samuel was a Levite. Even though Saul was king, he was not free simply to do that. He was not free simply to do that because he's only the king. He was not a priest. And as such, it was not for him to make sacrifices. Now, Saul knew that. He knew what the law said. The words of his response to Samuel tell you that he's trying to make excuses for himself. I felt compelled to do it. I knew I shouldn't have done it, but I felt compelled to do it. Saul understood that the role should be played by the Levites. The temptation was powerful. He could see the threat building against Israel. He could see his army shrinking. And apparently Samuel was late, though how late he could have been if he turned up immediately the sacrifice was finished is a different question. But the law of God is clear that the only people who can approach God on behalf of the people are the Levites. Even the king is not free to approach God in that way. Now that's a pretty serious deviation from God's law. And at least as we read this chapter, we get little sense that Saul has actually grasped how big it is. Maybe he's still thinking in terms of the thousands and thousands of Philistines who are camped just down the road. The narrative just continues. There's no apparent repentance. We don't know how much Saul took on board what Samuel had said. Samuel leaves Gilgal. Saul continues with his campaign. The situation in military terms still looks pretty hopeless. But a bomb has been quietly placed in the story at this point in verse 14. But now your kingdom shall not continue. That is explosive. The Lord has sought out a man after his own heart. The Lord has commanded him to be prince over his people because you have not kept what the Lord has commanded you to. It's explosive. It's going to completely change what happens in the rest of the book of 1 Samuel. I suppose because the kingship has only just been established, at the moment it feels neither here nor there. Well, Saul's only been a king for 5 minutes anyway, so really what difference does it make? But in the natural order of things, what we would expect to see is Saul established in his rule, followed perhaps by Jonathan, because we've already seen Jonathan behaving like a prince. Samuel says right here at the start of Saul's reign, that's not what's going to happen. You've blown it. Saul, your inability to do what you've been commanded to do as a king has already messed it up. What is the significance of this? Where do we go from here? What relevance does this have to us? This is an odd time in the history of Israel, but then I suppose the focus in the Bible is quite often on odd times. Several generations go past with nothing much happening, and then we zoom in onto the events of just a few weeks as they are showing us something happening in more detail. Now, what we see in this chapter looks like an example of a false start. There are others in the Bible, times when you think things are just about to be brilliant. Things are just about to be really wonderful. God is about to work in a new way amongst his people, and it's going to be fantastic. And then someone makes a mess of it. Just look at the incidents that we've seen up to this point in the Bible, without going any further forward. Noah comes out of the ark. The new world that he's been given. And he gets drunk and disgraces himself. God leads the people out of Egypt and gives his law to his people. And then Nadab and Abihu, the sons of Aaron, make a sacrifice to God in an inappropriate way and end up dead. The Israelites, led by God, capture and destroy Jericho. And then Achan takes stuff that he shouldn't have done. Gideon leads the Israelites against the Midianites. And then Gideon causes the Israelites to stumble. Just at the point where you think, God is really about to act in a new way. God can really move things forward here for his people. We've got a great platform. Human sin gets in the way and messes things up. The Israelites should not have been looking for a king, but nonetheless, God grants them their desire, and everything looks great. He does what a king is supposed to. He defeats the enemies of his people. But then rather than aligning himself with the framework that he's been given, he behaves as though he can define the law. He behaves as though he's the final authority. Now, if we simply read this in its own context, what we probably get from it is people mess things up again. God sets some things up, makes arrangements, in this case for his people to have a king, which is what they asked for, and Saul messes it up. But we're in a more privileged place in history as we have access to the whole of the Bible. A lot of the time, it's easy for us not to take advantage of that. There are lots of reasons. Sermons tend to take, say, just one chapter of one book in the middle of the Bible, like 1 Samuel 13, and speak about that quite often in isolation from the rest of the Bible. When we do Bible study, whether we have Bible reading notes or not, we're encouraged even to do 15 minutes or 5 minutes. Well, 15 minutes is better than nothing. 5 minutes is better than nothing. Anything that you do to study the Bible is better than nothing. That's important. And in that time, we read maybe a dozen verses, and we focus on getting something from that, from those verses. But what that means is, most of the time, we don't think about the big picture of the Bible, as was mentioned in the video earlier on. People don't have that big overview of what's going on. And what I mean by the big picture of the Bible is that it starts at the beginning of Genesis with our ancestors being thrown out of a garden and ends with people from every tribe, tongue and nation being welcomed back into a garden, and that there's a connection between those two things. But we can't deal with the whole of the Bible in the time that we've got left, can we? So is there a quick way to relate what happens in this chapter with that big picture? Are we simply left with this kind of bland, obvious fact that humans have an amazing ability to screw things up, which is what God has kicked out of the garden in the first place? Well, let's see where we can go with this. Right at the start, at the point humans left the Garden of Eden, God talked about how the effect of our sin would be overcome, how it might be reversed. And it's bound up with a figure who is first talked about in Genesis chapter 3, verse 15, just after the sin of Adam and Eve. And I will put enmity between you and the woman, and between your offspring and hers. He will crush your head, and you will strike his heel. These are words that were said to the serpent. At some point in history, this says, someone will come who can defeat the enemies of God's people and undo the effects of sin. At this point in the Bible, 1 Samuel chapter 13, at the start of the kingdom, we can see at least two aspects to this. The people of God need a king, first of all. They need someone who can fight the enemies of their enemies on their behalf. That's what they were looking for. But they also need a priest who can bring them into the presence of God. And at this point, God has said, in the framework that I've given you, these two things don't go together. The king and the priest are not the same person. The king that has been chosen can't be the priest. The person who fights for his people can't be the person who opens the way to God. This is actually something also that David is challenged with in his rule. And even trying to do this has spoiled Saul's kingship. But is it possible? Is it possible that the king can be the priest? Is it possible that those two roles, king and priest, can go together? Well, yes, it is. Here's a little account of a priest-king from Genesis chapter 14. Then Melchizedek, king of Salem, brought out bread and wine. He was priest of God Most High, and he blessed Abraham, saying, "Blessed be Abraham by God Most High, creator of heaven and earth, and praise be to God Most High, who delivered your enemies into your hand." Then Abraham gave him a tenth of everything. So can you see, Melchizedek there is talked about as being the king and a priest. Now Melchizedek is a mysterious figure who, I believe, literally only appears in person in those three verses, in the whole of the Bible. But he's referenced in Psalm 110. This is the Psalm of David, where David, who's the great king of Israel, is looking forward to his Lord. Now, David is saying in Psalm 110, the Lord said to my Lord. In other words, David, the king of Israel, is talking about someone who's greater than him. My Lord, someone greater than me. And in verse 4, he says, the Lord, that is God, has sworn and will not change his mind, and says to David's Lord, you are a priest forever in the order of Melchizedek. Now, King David is the greatest king that Israel sees. He's the benchmark king for the people of Israel. But David talks about his Lord, someone who David looks to as being greater than him. And not only is this his Lord, but his Lord will have a priestly role, like Melchizedek. And so we see Saul's failure as a king as he tries to act like a priest that he's not supposed to be because he's only the king. But when we look at the context of the whole Bible, we see that in fact the people of God do need a king who will be a priest. And of course, if you're familiar with the Bible, you're now running ahead of me. Because in Hebrews chapter 7, the writer talks about Jesus specifically being the fulfillment of Psalm 110. Now remember, we need a priest who can bring us into the presence of God. Under the law given to Israel, that should have been a Levite. Was Jesus a Levite? No, he was from Judah. He was from the tribe of Judah. Jesus was not part of the Levitical priesthood. He was actually a part of King David's royal line. So how can Jesus fulfill this priestly ministry? If Jesus is not a Levite, then how can he do that? Well, Hebrews 7 verse 26 says this. A great high priest truly meets our needs, one who is holy, blameless, pure, set apart from sinners, exalted above the heavens. Unlike the other high priests, he does not need to offer sacrifices day after day, first for his own sins and then for the sins of his people. He sacrificed for their sins once for all when he offered himself. That is how Jesus entered the priestly ministry on behalf of the people of God. He laid down his own life. He himself became the sacrifice that was needed. Jesus' priesthood was not going to take over part of the Levitical priesthood, like Saul tried to. It would go beyond that. Jesus' priesthood finds its shape in a pattern that's actually even older than the law itself. It goes back to Melchizedek. Now, in this context, and this really took my breath away when I noticed it, I'd like to point to an interesting event, a moment in Jesus' life, as it's described in Matthew chapter 3. Jesus came from Galilee to the Jordan to be baptized by John. But John tried to deter him, saying, "I need to be baptized by you, and do you come to me?" Jesus replied, "Let it be so now. It is proper for us to do this to fulfill all righteousness." Then John consented. Now, what had never struck me before about this is, what tribe do you think John the Baptist was in? Is a Levite. His father, Zechariah, was a priest, remember? And John was doing exactly the sort of thing that you would expect someone with a priestly ministry to do. He was baptizing for the repentance of sins. He was drawing people to God. When Jesus comes to him, John says to him, "Surely you should be baptizing me." Now, John the Baptist, of all people, gets who Jesus is. John understands that Jesus is the Messiah. John understands that Jesus is the one who is going to be the fulfillment of God's promises. And part of that is that John understands that Jesus is going to be the king priest that the people of God need. So in that context, this is a completely legitimate question. Jesus, you're going to be the king priest for your people. Am I doing your job? You know, I always thought it was a kind of a flippant question between cousins. But it's not. It has real weight. It has to do with Jesus' mission and the nature of the Levitical priesthood. John is confused. Jesus has come to him and is thinking, "But you're the priest king. Am I doing your job?" And especially in the book of Matthew, which is addressed to people from a Jewish background. This is their background. They understand this. They understand the connections between the tribes. They understand when they see that John is the son of Zechariah, they understand he's a Levite. He's doing these priestly things. And Jesus is the son of David. He's a king. But the two of those things somehow need to go together. But what is Jesus' answer? No. It's not for me to baptize you. There's two components. And 3 days ago was the first time in my life that I'd ever noticed this. Jesus is baptized to fulfill And his baptism is not because he needed to repent of sins, but because even as the king, he was showing himself to be subject to the law of God, someone who needed the Levitical priesthood. And that's why we're all baptized as well, when we become Christians. But not only is it the case that Jesus gets baptized, in answer to John's specific question, shouldn't you be baptizing me? Jesus doesn't become the baptizer. Even though Jesus is going to have a priestly ministry, even though in a sense this priestly ministry is what Jesus is all about, because the law of God separates the Levitical priesthood, the fulfillment of that law actually requires that Jesus doesn't take this over. It's not just about Jesus being baptized. It's about the fact that Jesus doesn't baptize John. And this week was the first time in my life that I noticed that. Jesus will have a priestly ministry. This is a ministry that is bigger than the Levitical priesthood. It's bigger than John the Baptist's ministry. But the way to that ministry is not to try to take over the Levitical ministry, which is what Saul did and was wrong, but to submit to it. And then through the sacrifice of himself, to become the high priest of the order of Melchizedek. The priesthood of Jesus is bigger, more fundamental than the Levitical priesthood. But for Jesus to have tried to do what the Levites were supposed to have been doing would have been wrong. Saul was only the king. It was wrong for him to try and fill the role of priest. And the consequence of that is that his kingship would end. And in fact, much of the rest of 1 Samuel shows what a mess this brings about. But what we can take from this, with the benefit of the whole Bible, is a greater appreciation of who Jesus is and what he came to do. An appreciation of the fact that Jesus did not go wrong, did not mess things up where Saul did. And the reminder that the priesthood of the Messiah is even greater, is much greater than the priesthood that God gave the Israelites through Moses. Amen.